This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we have a couple of our Friday favorites. News director Dave Thompson stops by to go beyond the week's headlines and dive a little deeper into the news. And Matt O'Lean reviews a couple of films and talks about the Oscar nominations. But joining me now in our Bismarck studio is Bill Patry. He is the president of the North Dakota Martin Luther King Holiday Commission. He's been active with the commission since 2011 and is currently serving as president. Bill, thank you for joining us today.
You're sure welcome.
There will be an observance in Bismarck at Trinity Lutheran Church starting at 7 p.m. And we should note that we have spoken with the keynote speaker, Jeff Stone, and you can hear that interview coming up on Monday's Hour of Main Street. Bill, how did you decide on this year's speakers?
That's a great question. We had initially thought of bringing in a speaker from out of state. We'd heard a YouTube video of him. He's a poet, dynamic speaker. And as we were discussing that, I was looking around the room where we were meeting at the United Church of Christ, and there's Jeffrey Stone. And I thought, why am I looking for somebody else? If you guys get a chance to see Dr. Stone, he's from Kentucky originally, a gifted performer as a musician, a choral director. And as I looked up, and when I was visiting with him in his office at Bismarck State College, I looked up at the books on his bookshelf and I'd read them all. And I thought, wow. You know, it was like a relative you never knew you had. And I was just stunned. I didn't know he even existed. And so I asked other people. I talked about other people. We tried to get our list of who should speak. And then it just hit me. Would Jeff do it? And initially, he didn't want to. And because he's a musician, he does speak on civil rights issues. And then he said, let me think about it. He talked to his wife. And so the group agreed, let's listen to Dr. Jeff.
We have already recorded that conversation, so I can tell you that there is a lovely section in that interview about the power of music and the role that that played in advancing civil rights. And again, you can hear that on Monday's Main Street. And Bill, you also picked Scott Davis with the Native American Commission. Why did you bring him in?
The Native American story is not told in North Dakota the way it should be. The civil rights issue in North Dakota goes back to the Civil War and following the war and the Indian Wars. And with the Dakota Access Pipeline controversy, all of a sudden we had an episode in North Dakota that reminded me of Selma, Alabama. And I thought, we need to hear that voice. And Scott Davis is the executive director of the Indian Affairs Commission, which is he represents and serves the governor and the tribal chairs of five tribal nations. His voice is just critical to hear at this time.
And then people will also be able to hear from a young man from the Congo, a refugee who is also quite famous in the community as a soccer player. Tell us about Merci.
He's a gifted soccer player, and I'm surprised at how many people know him. What he does, he's a student at Bismarck State College. He had scholarships to go play soccer other places. But Mercy is taking care of his parents. He drives a lot of people to appointments. He takes his parents to places they need to be. And he felt like he couldn't accept those scholarships and go somewhere else. He needed to be here in Bismarck. So that's who he is. He did provide testimony at the public hearing on whether or not Burleigh County should continue to accept refugees. The reason he's a good spokesman for that is Mercy comes across. He's not arrogant. He's not flashy, but he's a humble, competent person who's just enormously engaging. And when you meet him, you'll want to talk to him further. He's that kind of warm personality. Now, we had a tough time getting Mercy to agree. He's not a public speaker. Mm. You know, this was something he didn't want to do. And as I was asking him, his fellow soccer players were saying, come on, Mercy, you can do it. You can do it. And we're very glad that he did. So I think the audience, and he's not going to try and pretend that he's some kind of public speaker, but his story, when you hear Mercy's story about how he got to America, the tragedies that he's seen, and the kind of character that he has, it will just simply inspire you.
When you get a group of speakers like this, and of course when we honor the great man, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course we are talking about hundreds of years of slavery and horrendous civil rights abuses, and you bring in a member like Scott Davis, who would represent an indigenous perspective, and the slavery and attempted genocide and similar amount of years, the decades and centuries of abuses committed against them. And then in a more modern day, you're bringing in a refugee. How do you get a group of speakers to talk about all of these really terrible things, which we need to remember, without making it something that just feels depressing? Do you know what I mean?
I do. I'm speaking at the United Tribes Technical College, and I have prepared my message for them. And it's on that same subject. How do you approach what's wrong with America and the extreme racism in this country that is just crippling us, and leave the room with some reason to hope, some inspiration? But that's exactly what Dr. King did. Mm-hmm. And when we look at his example, what he was able to do, and why it's not so hard to get people to talk about it, because deep inside of us, these are things we already knew. When you read ancient scriptures, the Old Testament, people were oppressed in the days of Isaiah. And you read Jesus talking, and his people were oppressed in the time of the Roman Empire. And King's people were oppressed, and Sitting Bull's people were oppressed. So the same theme, it's a very ancient theme, oppression and the search for freedom, and then what inspires the ancient ones and the modern ones is the ancient wisdom that comes to us like a spirit, almost like in a Christian world we'd say the Holy Spirit. Native Americans would say the spirit of our ancestors, and they come like angels and talk to us, and they tell us, here's how you should behave. And that's in all of us. That's not a white person's perspective or a Native American's perspective or a black person's perspective. That's in us. And that spirit starts talking. And that's what King harnessed. You know, when you heard him, I have a dream that someday my children will be judged by the quality of their character, not the color of their skin. Isn't that our dream? You know, so it's so universal. We simply need to tap it again.
Martin Luther King was, of course, assassinated many decades ago. Being on the Holiday Commission, how are you able to continue to make programming that leaves us still with something to learn about this man?
He's such a remarkable person that the unlayering and the learning about King is really a wonderful, fulfilling adventure. There's so much I didn't know. I graduated from high school in 1967. I went to college in Oregon, Portland, Oregon, and in 1968. I was taking a class in Western civilization. In April of 1968, King was killed. Being from Fessenden, North Dakota, I really didn't know too much about Dr. King. And I remember our that professor of that class looked at us young students and said, "This is an awful dark day in the world history." It was a class in Western civilization, and I didn't draw Western civilization to Martin Luther King. You know, I was just trying to pass the class, and that hit me so hard that why didn't I know about this guy? And now, in the 52 years since then, I've been learning his connections to North Dakota, the connections of his teachings with ancient scriptures and modern thinkers. And you know, it's a rewarding thing to study, because Dr. King himself is a fascinating, brilliant intellectual beyond being a good speaker. He's that. So the learning part of it, as you ask, you know, it's actually fun.
What are those connections to North Dakota?
They're really deep. In 1961, the Luther League held its triennial convention in Miami Beach, Florida. Most North Dakotans had never been to Miami Beach, Florida. And now this is for teenagers and their chaperones. And it's a big deal. 12,000 people, young people and their chaperones, go to this thing. And they have a lot of speakers. A young man who was a newly appointed chair of the youth ministries in the American Lutheran Church, L. David Brown, he was from Minneapolis at the time, suggested to the people planning this triennial conference that they should have Dr. King speak. And immediately, his higher-ups across the American Lutheran Church said, "That's not a good idea." And if you know about 1961, King was considered very radical. The FBI thought he might be a communist. You know, it was a very dangerous time in America. But the national bishop overrode that and said, "Yeah, let's hear him." So L. David Brown, whose father was John Nikolai Brown, who was at one time the president of Concordia College in Moorhead, went and talked King into coming to speak to that. Now, so just that event, you think about how courageous those players were to bring this radical person to speak to the young people. Then the response by the Lutheran churches in North Dakota is remarkable. They joined with churches in Montana and Minnesota, and they formed a passenger train with numerous cars, and they, by train, delivered 900 people to Miami Beach, Florida, from North Dakota and Minnesota and Montana. I've worked as a youth minister in Alabama once. What a nightmare. Who would do that? You know, I mean, just the physical act of getting 900 people someplace safely and getting them home. And at the event on Monday night, people will see photos of those teenagers. I've talked to some of them. One lady told me, "I just went there because there was going to be boys, you know." And you know, they're teenagers.
Yeah,
and they didn't.
It's a motivator.
They didn't understand the sunshine, and they got terribly sunburned. You know, just silliness. But some of those who heard King, it changed their lives. Not everyone, of course, but Tom Dolly was one of those. He was 16 years old at the time, and something stuck, something King said. One of the quotes that I've heard him say, and it's on the DVD that you'll be able to buy, is after Dr. King's speech, a young teenager walked up and said, and he was kind of nervous, wearing a white shirt and dark trousers, and he said, "Dr. King, aren't you worried that you're asking people to do too much too soon? And that you're going to have violence, you're going to create more violence that you don't want on your people?" And Dr. King's answer still haunts me to this day. And he said, "We believe that our group is more capable of, can outdoor you in suffering past your ability to hate." And it's a difficult lesson to learn, because King was talking about nonviolence. And the people who practice nonviolence are the ones who suffer the violence. They don't cause it, they suffer it. And when we showed that DVD at our United Church of Christ, I looked around the room and there were people crying. Because he called teenagers to that level, and most people, I mean, don't like to talk about it very long, because that is something amazing. Now, fast forward in my life, in 1965, in the summer of 65, I was just going to become a junior at Fesden High School, and I was 16. And I don't know who did this to this day, but somebody brought Dr. Delwyn Brown from Jamestown College. He was a philosophy professor at Jamestown College. He was 30 years old, young guy. He came to our youth group in Bowdoin, North Dakota, and he talked about walking with Dr. King in the Selma to Montgomery March. You know, I wasn't even paying attention to that. So we didn't actually have a TV. So I wasn't paying attention to that march. And he came and Little Church of God in Bowdoin, and he's talking. And I remember I didn't know anything about philosophy, didn't know what that was, and didn't know too much about what was going on. And I remember one of my colleagues asked Delwyn Brown, he said, "Dr. Brown, do black people smell different than white people?" And Dr. Brown said, well, he said, even though it was only March in Alabama, still spring in North Dakota, he said it was very hot there. And as we walked, we got all sweaty. And none of us smelled good, he said. But, you know, I don't think I noticed any difference between a black person and a white person. And, you know, I can tell you that story this many years later. It struck me. I don't know what motivated Delwyn Brown to go march, but two other North Dakotans went as well. Frank Woodall, who was a pastor of the little churches at Obron in Cheyenne, North Dakota, a Lutheran minister, and Byron Knutson. And Byron Knutson was a railroad worker near Minnewaukan, North Dakota. Isn't that something? You know, those three people, unchoreographed, felt called to go walk with King from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama.
Do you think a lot of people realize how much of this is still very recent history? And I'll pick on myself here. I remember being in a radio meeting maybe 2 years ago with our Mike Olson, who hosts music programming here. And he mentioned something about growing up when he was very young in New Orleans, and then just as an aside, very casually said, yeah, and it was still segregated then. And I was like, what? That these things were still happening very comfortably within the lifetimes of people that I know.
Yes, and I talked to Byron Knutson about it. People who went were actually taking their life in their hands because they were called carpetbaggers, people from the north coming to the south. They weren't welcome. People protesting for civil rights, white people were not welcome, and they were killed. This was not some passive, religious, intellectual thing. This was putting your life on the line. And the Edmund Pettus Bridge story is told often, but the violence and the ugliness of Edmund Pettus Bridge, you know, I mentioned earlier, when I saw film clips of what was happening at the DAPL protest, I got that haunting memory, you know, came floating back, that violence is meeting nonviolence and they're suffering. And you're right. I think for most North Dakotans, we've never seen it before. We didn't know about it. It wasn't something we were involved in, not as young people. And probably to this day, most young people aren't engaged in thinking about those issues.
You've mentioned the protesting at the Standing Rock Reservation about the Dakota Access Pipeline. And then at the beginning of this conversation, we talked about the refugee from the Congo who will be speaking at this event. And again, it's at 7 p.m. at Bismarck's Trinity Lutheran Church coming up on Monday. And I read a piece that you wrote recently for the Bismarck Tribune where you talk about the current political climate in the state and you write about the refugee resettlement in Burley County. And so I'm just wondering how you draw this thread between what you saw when you were in your teens and this was happening, and then how does it relate to what you're seeing now as the state has voted to continue to accept refugees?
The first thing to say is let's cheer, let's celebrate, and I'm not a prophet, but I've always felt in my bones that the people I grew up with in Wells County, the evangelical Christians, and now the people I've met on the intellectual side of life who might not even be Christians, we have it in our gut to be decent, welcoming, compassionate human beings. That's what I believe we've always been. And yes, the political rhetoric of today is fear and hatred and all of those things. And people are trying to cast refugees as maybe undesirables and that they'll overwhelm our system and those sort of things. But what I felt, and I felt this at the public hearing with Burley County, there's an adult in the room. That's all of us in the adults section that are like Martin Luther King's answer to the young teenager. You know, no, we're not scared at this moment. We're not frightened by the negative things that are going on because we believe in each other and in those refugees. And deep-seated in us, whether we're Christian believers or Hindus or Buddhists or atheists, is this, that spark of human compassion that when it's ignited rallies people together. And that's what happened. That's what is happening. You know, hatred can, unfortunately, we're going to get a lot of that. But what King taught us was the only way to cast out hate is to love. That's the only thing that works. And you saw that. You know, there's hate on both sides, of course. But what King talked about in that lesson, and it's why it's so relevant to refugees, is it's, in my situation, it's easy to love refugees. They're not hard to love. And so it's not hard to stand up for them.
Bill Patrie is president of the North Dakota Martin Luther King Holiday Commission, and he has been active with the commission since 2011, talking about an event that will be happening at 7 p.m. at Bismarck's Trinity Lutheran Church, and that's 7 p.m. Central, coming up on Monday with speakers Dr. Jeffrey Stone, who is an assistant professor at Bismarck State College and who is a choral director there who will be speaking about pursuing the American dream. Scott Davis with the Indian Affairs Commission will also be speaking, and there'll be a young refugee from the Congo who will also be speaking at this event. Bill, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Still to come on Main Street, we get a news debrief with Dave Thompson, and Madeline reviews Bombshell and 1917. But first, this news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Passenger boardings at the Bismarck Municipal Airport were up nearly 10% in 2019 compared with 2018. That's a new record. Airport manager Greg Haug says for the past 10 years, Bismarck has seen growth in passenger numbers.
I think it's just the local economy and, you know, obviously the energy activity out in western North Dakota. I think people are just flying more, you know, flying to different destinations, taking little short trips here or there, flying for business. It's just more commonplace these days. And with the additional air service offerings that Bismarck has put out there in the last several years, you know, I mean, we just got more options, more choices, more airlines, more direct destinations, and people are traveling.
7 of the 8 commercial airports in North Dakota saw increased passenger numbers in 2019. Haug says he's looking forward to continued growth in 2020. Farmers and landowners enrolling in one of the biggest federal conservation programs can now select prairie strips as a practice to improve water quality. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, the new option emerged from a search at Iowa State University.
Scientists at Iowa State showed more soil stayed in place, fewer nutrients reached waterways, and wildlife numbers increased when small amounts of native prairie were added to the landscape. Next, farmers and landowners tried prairie strips on their fields. ISU's Lisa Schulte Moore says the work attracted attention and funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And then prairie strips got written into the Farm Bill as a practice approved for the Conservation Reserve Program.
We were exceptionally excited. You know, most scientists don't get an opportunity to see the fruits of their research end up influencing federal law.
It took just over a year for the details to be worked out, but now farmers can walk into their Farm Service Agency office and select prairie strips for their conservation acres. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Cass County deputies used a plow and then snowmobiles to rescue several people stuck in a vehicle on a township road north of Fargo this morning. Sheriff Jesse Johnner says he used a newly purchased front-mounted snowblade attached to the Sheriff Department's Search and Rescue 3/4-ton pickup to reach the stranded people, but the snow was so deep, the snowmobiles were called in to make the rescue.
You know, they were fairly quite a ways away from a road that was, you know, that we could travel down, and we did try to get to them with the use of the snowplow. We could only make it a certain distance to them, so then we deployed our snowmobiles to get to them and brought them back to our vehicles, and they're all good and safe now.
Those brought to safety were headed to help another stuck vehicle when they got caught in the snow. Johnner asked for additional funding from the Cass County Commission earlier this month to cut down on delays in responding to emergency calls, which happened during the late December blizzard. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Well, there's the sound of the old wire machine, and that means it is time to go beyond the headlines with our news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us once a week from our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks.
You bet, Ashley.
So we talked about this a little bit last week, but now we have a little bit better sense of the numbers and where these cuts are going to come from. The interim president of Dickinson State with a $7 million budget reduction across 2 years.
Right, across 2 years, and we've got a number of people have taken early retirements, but you're talking about a reduction in force of about 36 positions.
Wow.
That includes the ones that are being left vacant and also the ones who have taken early retirement and taken a buyout, so to speak.
Out of 36 positions, do you know like what percentage of the workforce at DSU that means?
I did not have time to figure that out. I was looking that up and then got torn away when I was putting the story together.
Okay, but 6 academic programs to be eliminated.
There were a couple interesting ones there. Mathematics.
And also English.
But there is another program for English teachers that they're going to keep working with that program because, you know, Dickinson also has roots as a teacher's college.
Well, can we talk about this mathematics one, though? Because you always expect to see music, art, and languages as the first ones on the chopping block, but you never see math.
I know. That was an odd one for me, too. But he said that there are other programs that will pick that up. And we're talking about 20, 25 students who majored in those 6 degree categories, these 6 bachelor degree categories. And they'll be able to find some way because Dickinson's going to cooperate with other colleges to present some of these programs too.
Wow, cooperating with colleges.
Yeah.
Also on a career note, the director of the Career and Technical Education said that there is a big demand for more training.
That's correct. If you think about the energy industry, a lot of the jobs in the energy industry, and they're very good paying jobs, do not require a 4-year bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
They require more of a certificate or maybe a 2-year associate degree. And there's a lot of demand for that. And I have relatives who work at one of the manufacturing firms in the Bismarck Mandan area, and they say they're always looking for welders.
Okay.
And welders get fairly good pay to start.
And across the state, there are only 5 physical locations where people can get the sort of hands-on, and then there's also 5 virtual programs.
Yes, exactly.
Which seems a curious way to learn a very hands-on skill in a lot of cases.
Right, but that's why they require people, you know, these students to go to centers once in a while, maybe a couple of times a semester,
okay,
so they can get the hands-on experience.
Any particular part of the state they're saying needs more?
Basically, they're talking about West River country, west of Missouri.
West of Bismarck, okay.
Yeah, and also, you know, there have been a lot of proposals to bring a CTE center to the Fargo-Moorhead area, too.
Mandan Diesel Fuel Recovery Project nears an end after 36 years?
Mm-hmm. And I remember that story very well because in 1984, they were getting ready to build a new law enforcement center in downtown Mandan. And when they drilled the pylons, they noticed that in the groundwater, there was this diesel sheen on it. And so they did some work and some research, and everything went back to the old railroad yards. So BNSF had some diesel fuel spills. And there was a period of time where they were negotiating to try to figure out how much BNSF is going to pay for the remediation. They came up with a $30 million fee. $24 million went directly to cleanup, and $6 million went for other remediation. And now they've done some testing in the wells, and now they're not seeing diesel fuel in the groundwater. So there will be a meeting next week in order to say, should we just close it down now? We think we've got everything.
Wow. So were they presumably doing tests periodically throughout the 36 years, or did they just forget?
Oh, no. Oh, no. They were doing tests all the time. They had test wells all the time.
And it took that long.
Oh, there was an awful lot of diesel that was spilled underneath there. I never heard a true estimate, but at one point, somebody was talking about hundreds of gallons down there. So, you know, because of the trains.
Yeah, I was looking, as I was prepping for this debrief, there were a number of stories where I thought, well, that's got to be a typo, 36 years. And then here is another one. Roughly 20 to 30% of the sunflower harvest is still
in the ground.
In the ground, and they think they're going to get it.
Right.
Or now, could. They're going to try anyway.
Sunflower growers are being very tenacious about this. When they get a chance to see drier ground, and if they can get out in the fields, they're going to get the sunflowers off because sunflower prices are actually pretty good. They're
6-year high.
Yeah, 6-year high. They're up about $2 per hundredweight. And even the, you know, crop that would be planted in 2020 is up by like $1, $1.50 per hundredweight. So the prices are pretty decent, and they really want to get that product to market.
And how can you be doing that in this weather?
In this weather, I don't know how. I think they have to wait until closer to springtime when things start drying out, when the snow starts melting a bit. And, you know, snow melts, but that also leaves muddy trails, and that's hard to get tractors through there. But, you know, if you get a case where it's melted and then maybe starts drying off, maybe you can get in the fields.
If it ends up staying in the field, will it impact next season's crop?
It could very well impact next season's crop, but, you know, As I said, these sunflower farmers are willing to go. And in talking to some people in the corn industry, they thought, you know, their best case scenario, and this is around the Jamestown area, was that they would harvest the 2019 crop maybe a week before planting and then plant right away,
Wow. Which
is not the best way to do it, but that's the hand of dealt.
Tired farmers, too.
Yeah, that's for sure.
The Public Service Commission is scheduling work sessions on an expansion of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Mm-hmm. And the work session is scheduled for Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock. And they're going to be talking about, do they need to have more documentation? Do they need anything more from either Energy Transfer Partners or from the opponents, like the tribe, before they make the decision? The PSC members were saying, we think we have enough information now. We just have to work through a couple of particular issues.
Okay, so Energy Transfer wanting to double the pipeline capacity
from
500,000 to 1 million. And you said, of course, that the tribe opposes this expansion.
Right, the tribe is worried about potential leaks. If you put more pressure on the lines, because that's how it's going to be done, you're going to just put more oil through the pipeline. If you're going to compress it more, does that increase the risk of leakage? And Energy Transfer says, no, it does not. The pipelines are well built.
So this meeting that you said that's coming up on Wednesday, will people be able to speak at it from both sides?
No, this is going to be a work session.
Okay.
So it'll just be commission staff and commission members.
There's some issues about a proposed wind farm in McLean County, Russo Farm. Mm-hmm. So this is a farm that they're hoping to put about 60 wind turbines on.
Right.
And recently, so there's been this issue with permitting and talking about light mitigating technology. But I understand that isn't quite the same issue facing this wind farm as other wind farms.
The state law says if you're permitted after 2018 – you have to have this technology in place mm-hmm. before the first of the year. Well, and there's no wiggle room in the state law. The trouble with Russo is you have the Air Force objecting to it because it's using radar. And the Air Force has objected to it, and now the Public Service Commission is trying to figure out, is there a workaround? Is there something that could be done so that this wind farm can start producing electricity?
How close would this be to the Minot Air Force Base?
Well, it's northern McLean County, so it's fairly close to Ward County where the base is. And they're worried about, you know, the wind farm being in flight plans for the B-52s.
This is a story that I read in the Bismarck Tribune. The Park Board had a split debate on renaming Custer Park. So this happened last night. There's been a request to rename this, and they specifically used the phrase passionate testimony.
Very passionate debate, and I watched a lot of the debate, and it was very passionate on both sides. The Custer people who want the name to remain were very, very adamant that it should. And then a lot of the Native American community was the one saying, hey, Custer, you know, was a killer, and we shouldn't be honoring him with a park. So there was a lot of discussion back and forth. And what the commission has done is asking its staff to go back and write a policy so they can have a policy on naming and renaming parks that could guide the discussion.
Oh, okay. Any sense of when that policy, like, is there a deadline on that?
Yeah, they wanted it for the February meeting, so next month it'll probably be again.
Okay.
But again, this may be a discussion issue just for the commissioners, and there probably won't be public testimony. I can't say that for an absolute certainty, but that's what they were leaning toward last night.
So here is another story that I thought, is this a typo? The Goodrich and McCluskey schools will be co-oping for high school.
Right, 7 through 12 grades.
Right, because Goodrich would have
four students in grades 7 through 12, exactly, yes.
Wow. Why didn't they co-op a lot sooner?
I think it's because, you know, there's pride in towns that, you know, the idea of co-oping has not been a real popular idea, but Goodrich understands that the situation is that it's in the county, in Sheridan County, there are not a lot of young people.
Right.
So they're trying to get people to move back to Sheridan County or to move into Sheridan County. But right now, if you're talking about when you combine the two, it's going to be 19 students, grade 7 through 12. So still not a lot of students, but at least enough to populate five grades.
So they are co-oping the high schools. Why are they keeping the elementary schools separate?
It's basically because there are a lot of people in town who want a school there because they don't want to drive. And they don't know if McCluskey has room right now in the elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, you're driving at least 30 miles to any of the other schools.
Right, and you start thinking about those late sports nights too.
Right, right.
In 2019, the second busiest year for North Dakota airports, with almost all of the airports seeing an increase, right? Seven of the eight,
that's right. The only one that didn't was Jamestown. Jamestown was down just about 1.5%. But, you know, I was talking to the airport manager in Bismarck and also to the airport manager in Fargo, and both said, you know, these were record years. As a matter of fact, Sean Doberstein, who is the airport director in Fargo, said, we have a lot of cargo going through Fargo, too, so just it makes it a very busy airport. And in Bismarck, that airport has set records every year for the past 10 in terms of employment.
Every year for 10 years?
Every year for 10 years. They're getting better and better. More flights are coming in, more choices to destinations. You know, when I was growing up, Bismarck and Denver were the only spots.
Right. Just a few seconds left here. Allegiant announced it will do a direct seasonal flight Fargo to Nashville. Any other big flight announcements in the state?
Not that I'm willing to share just yet, but there's some illusion that there could be, and, you know, stay tuned, there could be more announcements coming.
Oh, I hope it's to the West Coast or Hawaii.
Yeah, there you go.
A direct flight to Hawaii. Okay. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, there's the fanfare. That means it's time to welcome movie critic Matt Olien in studio. You have seen a couple films, so always around the Oscar time, We're doubling up on films here. And this first one you want to talk about looks pretty epic.
Boy, 1917, the World War I film directed by Sam Mendes, who, of course, won the Oscar 20 years ago for directing American Beauty.
That's 20 years old.
It's 20 years old, and he's gunning for his second directing nomination, or he actually got a nomination, but his second win. So this is a phenomenal motion picture. And from a marketing standpoint, they held this film back from general release till last week. And it was a stroke of genius because Star Wars had kind of run through about 3 weeks, and lo and behold, 1917 took the top spot at the box office last weekend because of the hype. Sometimes they do this in award seasons. They'll let the LA and New York critics see it in December, and then we here in the Midwest and the hinterlands get to see it on January 10th. So the big trick of this film is how they shot it. So two soldiers, British soldiers, are given orders by Colin Firth, who plays a high-ranking colonel or general, that they have to travel. We're not sure how long, but it's a bit of a hike to get to this division to call off an attack because it's a trap, and they're going to get massacred by the Germans. So one of the two soldiers who's sent, his brother is an officer in that division, so he's trying to save his brother as well. The two soldiers are played by Dean Charles Chapman, who was King Tommen in Game of Thrones, and George MacKay, who really gives a wonderful performance. So that's basically it. We follow them through their journey, through all kinds of hell, all kinds of trauma, to try, I'm not going to tell you what happens, try to get to the front lines to warn Benedict Cumberbatch, who's the colonel in charge, to call off the attack. And through this journey, there are literally a handful of edits in the whole film. It's basically like you're watching a theatrical play. The camera follows the two soldiers. Everything has to be on cue. I can't even imagine the rehearsal time for this. If one thing goes wrong, they have to start again. Most films are cut together, which does help with emotion sometimes, with, you know, dissolves and cutting from close up to close up. This time it's all a roving camera, kind of almost prowling after the two actors. And it really creates a phenomenal cinematic experience. Some people have complained the film isn't emotional enough for them because there's no cutting, no close-ups, not a lot of close-ups. I found it to be emotionally affecting. Along the way, we see four major stars. Colin Firth, Benedict Cumberbatch, look for Richard Madden from Game of Thrones, who played Robb Stark, Mark Strong. They're like little placeholders along the way as these two soldiers go along their way, meet these officers who are usually played by bigger stars than they are. But it's a phenomenal experience. Certainly will take its place as one of the great World War I films ever, along with All Quiet on the Western Front and Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas.
And then the other film that you saw, a very different kind of action told in a very different kind of way, Bombshell.
So I saw this a couple weeks ago, been kind of holding this one back. Got three Oscar nominations. Margot Robbie who plays kind of a composite character. She's a very ambitious young journalist who wants to anchor at Fox News. And Charlize Theron plays Megyn Kelly in an uncanny performance.
I thought it was Megyn Kelly in the trailer.
It's a phenomenal piece of acting. She's got Megyn Kelly's mannerisms down. Megyn Kelly has tweeted her support of this performance, apparently, because she's seen it. And the third nomination was makeup and hairstyling, which you can understand that because we're at Fox News and, you know, appearance is a huge thing at Fox News. So John Lithgow plays Roger Ailes. The film takes place during the 2016 presidential campaign when Ailes was eventually accused of sexual harassment by Gretchen Carlson, who's played by Nicole Kidman. And she kind of has that Minnesota accent down. Gretchen Carlson, of course, from the Twin Cities. So that's what the film's about. I wanted it to be a little deeper. The performances are great, but I have a feeling that director Jay Roach, I just wanted a little bit more gravitas. It almost feels like it's a two-hour soap opera. There are some interesting editing techniques. The film starts with Charlize Theron talking to the audience. Here's what you're about to see. So there are some interesting, you know, breaking the fourth wall techniques that are used. And each character has that moment in the film to kind of break the fourth wall, whether it's Megyn Kelly or Gretchen Carlson or Margot Robbie as the composite character. But what really drives this film are the three performances by the three female stars I mentioned. And Charlize Theron is right at the top of that. So it's a watchable film. It's interesting to go behind the scenes as to what happened at Fox News, how Roger Ailes' behavior was covered up over the years.
Has Fox News said anything?
I have not noticed any commentary. You know, typically if Fox News talks about movies, it's usually negative, you know, Hollywood, left wing, et cetera, et cetera. I have not really heard much reaction. I mean, Roger Ailes is now dead, and so I know Megyn Kelly liked the film, and what I found unrealistic in a couple of the parts is there's a point in the film where kind of the lid is off, and Gretchen Carlson has filed her suit, and she's looking for other women to step forward, and of course, they're hesitant at first. And there's a couple scenes where Megyn Kelly, Charlize Theron, is kind of walking through the newsroom asking women if they were harassed. I can't believe she would have done that in kind of an open newsroom way. Mm. That's more of a private conversation. I could be wrong, but that seemed a little unrealistic to me. But go to see it for the performances. That's the big thing.
A big thing for you is Oscars, mm-hmm. and we got the nominations this week.
Yes.
So anything surprise you?
I was surprised Joker led the way with 11 nominations. Joker's a really good film, but for it to have the most nominations tells me the Academy really likes this movie. Now, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood had 10, 1917 had 10, and The Irishman had 10. So they're all right in the mix. Parasite got 6 nominations, the excellent South Korean film. But that tells me a couple things. It tells me that Joaquin Phoenix clearly is the favorite to win Best Actor as Joker. He kind of gave a rambling, slurring speech at the Golden Globes, and you're kind of wondering, does the Academy really want him up there without a teleprompter? You never know what Joaquin's going to say. But I think their love of this film shows that he probably is the front runner. I think Best Picture, Ashley, is really going to come down to 1917, which now has the momentum, versus Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I can see a split where 1917 gets Picture and Tarantino finally gets his Best Director Oscar. He does have 2 screenplay Oscars. I could see that happening as well. But overall, the nominations were pretty good. I like the acting nominations for the most part. There's a couple I wish would have gotten in. Lupita Nyong'o in Us would have been a nice nomination. Awkwafina, so good in The Farewell. And the one category I thought they mangled was supporting actress. Zhao Shuzhen, who played the old grandmother in The Farewell, is so good. I don't know how she was left off that list. Jennifer Lopez should have been nominated for Hustlers. Instead, they put in Kathy Bates and Richard Jewell, which is not a very good film from what a lot of critics have said. Mm. And does Scarlett Johansson need that second nomination for Jojo Rabbit? I'm not a big Jojo Rabbit fan. She's great in Marriage Story. That's a fine nomination.
Was, yeah.
But I think they could have made that category a little stronger. Now I think Laura Dern is clearly the favorite in Marriage Story.
All right, so I have a trivia question for you. So we'll go back to the first film that you did, 1917. Mm-hmm. Like you said, very few edits in this film. Obviously, it was not all shot in one take.
No, it was not.
But
it looks
made
like
to
it
look
was.
Like that. Mm-hmm. And that technique with the Hidden Edits is sort of first credited as used in what 1948 film?
Rope by Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah,
he basically shot a play.
Yep. All right. We've been in the movies with Matt Olien.
The University of Mary in Bismarck presents the 47th Annual Jazz Festival Concerts. On Friday, January 31st at 7:30 p.m. in Founders Hall in the new Lumen Vitae University Center. The concert features UMary Jazz Ensemble and Vocal Jazz with nationally renowned artists Nestor Torres on flute, Ruben Caban on trombone, Jorge Luis Sosa on keyboards, Augustine Conti on bass, Ray Monroy on drums, Edwin Bonilla providing percussion, and Amy Nolte and Justin Binnick with Vocal Jazz. The concert is free and open to the public. Doors will be open to the general public at 7 p.m.
This is Dakota Depot for January 17th. The bizarre cause of a Minot fire was reported on this date in 1916, along with this sadistic story involving the culprit. The fire had occurred in Minot a few days earlier and had consumed the entire Blakey Roll Block. Arthur Heilman was arrested in connection with the fire by the Minot police on a charge of arson and assault. A few days earlier, Heilman, who owned a small business in the basement of one of the block's buildings, had been drinking with a few friends. When one of his pals, a man named Westergaard, fell asleep in the building, Heilman took the opportunity to pull a prank on the drunken man. Heilman soaked the bottom of Westergaard's pants in wood alcohol and then proceeded to light the pants on fire. Westergaard awoke, and his efforts to put the flames out spread the fire to the rest of the room. The fire quickly overtook the rest of the building. Westergaard emerged badly burned from the incident, and he was rushed to a local doctor for treatment. It was fortunate that he did not burn to death as a result of the prank. Due to the sensitive nature of the crime, authorities decided to keep the details of the fire concealed until the testimony of the patient could be properly recorded and the culprit positively identified. Heilman waived his right to a preliminary hearing and was issued a bail of $2,000. The bail was unusually high, but it was deemed fair in light of the seriousness of the crime. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jamie Jobe. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We do have a weather announcement to pass along to our listeners. Anybody who has tickets to the 23rd Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music, it has been canceled because of the weather. That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, we hear from Dr. Jeffrey Stone of Bismarck State College, who will be giving the keynote address at an upcoming Martin Luther King Jr. holiday observance. That's coming up Monday on the show. Until then, stay safe, stay warm.